The civil war in Syria is one of the undoubted horrors of our times. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed and billions of dollars of damage have been done, essentially to keep President Bashar al-Assad in power. Mike Thompson is a very widely travelled BBC correspondent who's written about, in particular, the besieged Syrian town of Daraya, which houses something which is really rather extraordinary. And I'm delighted to speak to Mike this morning. Good morning, Mike. Welcome to the show. Mike, good morning. Welcome to Talk Radio Europe.
Good morning to you, Bill.
Well, this is an extraordinary story, this, and let's first of all by talking about Daraya itself. It's on the fringe of Damascus, and kind of paint a picture of what's going on there for us.
Well, before the war, Daraya had been a source of peaceful protest for quite a few decades. A lot of young people there had got together and had various sit-ins and even, in fact, tried to start a library at one point because of the censorship of books. So they were a bit of a thorn in the side, even the, quite a passive one at that point. And Daraya was a town that was a dormitory town, as you say, on the doorstep of Damascus, a bit of a commuter place. It was cheaper to live there than in central Damascus, so many people would then commute from there into the city. It was an agricultural town and full of lots of furniture makers and small businesses.
Right, and then since 2011, effectively, it was besieged by Syrian government forces, and the people really had an incredibly hard time of it.
They did indeed. From 2012, when the Syrian government forces went into Daraya and killed a large number of people, anything up to something like 700, although the figures are disputed, from that point on, anyone who could get out of Daraya did. They left, but the rest, about 8,000 of something like 80,000, stayed, and they were bombed and bombarded every day, just about, and snipers would, government snipers, and of course there were some rebel snipers too, but the government snipers would be up in the high buildings that overlooked much of the town, so even crossing the road or walking out of your door could be a deadly experience.
And why was Daraya picked on particularly? Was it because Bashar had decided they had kind of dangerous revolutionaries there?
Well, a little bit like that, Bill. I think also because it's right on the doorstep, as we said. So it's right next to the seat of power, and there it is defying the government there.
Right.
And I think that was part of it. And, of course, a long history, as I said, of protest against the government has long stood out as an area that was opposed to Assad's rule. So it was a score that he wished to settle. And being right next door to the capital, he probably felt initially he could do it quite quickly.
So we're talking here about somewhere that's kind of laying in ruins, effectively. The office buildings, the shops, the family homes are all shattered. It's a place,
yes,
of devastation. But yet, as we all now learn, amongst that devastation, first of all, it's worth pointing out, even if you wanted to go there, could you have gone there?
No, I couldn't have done. It's one of the things that I looked into. I even asked the people there, is there any way you could smuggle me in?
Right.
And the immediate response was, look, it would be incredibly dangerous. You finish the book first. We really want to see the book. Don't try to get into Daraya.
Wow. So what was the inspiration behind the book? What was it that made you pick this particular story?
Well, what happened initially was I was phoning around covering for news what it's like to live under siege, getting an impression of that from people on the ground. And one of the places, one of the first places I called was Daraya. And I spoke to someone there and I said to them, how do you survive not just from the physical devastation and the lack of food, but mentally, psychologically, how do you deal with being sniped at every day, with being bombed and shelled? And he said, oh, well, we have a secret weapon. And when he said that, I thought they had some sort of massive super gun or something.
Yeah, of course.
But he said, it's our secret library.
Amazing.
And he started to describe to me that at that point they had fewer books, but it grew and grew and grew with what they had there. And it was just this incredible picture in my head. You know, there was the hell of war above, the bombs, the shells, the snipers erupting all over. And just a few feet below these shattered streets was a literary sanctuary, perhaps the best way to put it, and a place of peace, a tranquility of learning, and really a completely another world.
How were you communicating with people there then? Did they have internet and mobile phones? I mean, they had no food almost, or no medical supplies, but did they have the communication lines?
Well, amazingly, yes. I mean, I was stunned how you could get through by internet. Phone lines were very difficult, but
right.
But the internet. And I was told actually one of the reasons for this was the forces besieging Daraya also needed to use the internet. So if they cut it off completely, they sort of, you know, shot themselves in the foot as well.
Yes.
So that was part of it. But sometimes you could go for a day or two, maybe three, where there was no internet at all. I couldn't get through to anybody. But I was going via things like FaceTime, WhatsApp in particular, Skype, that sort of thing, and managing to get through quite often. Sometimes enough, it was a good enough signal to even get a video line so I could see the people the other end, and which was very helpful when
wow.
it came to the book. Other occasions, it was just an audio line, and I got people to describe everything to me.
So here we are. We have something which is buried beneath a bomb-damaged building. It's down a flight of steep steps, pretty much as far as it's possible to go from the shrapnel and the sniper's bullets above. How did the books get there, and where did they come from? I can't imagine Amazon delivered there.
No, exactly. All these books came from bombed, abandoned homes or office blocks, and there were the occasional sort of municipal-type library. And they were all sort of lying in places with, as I say, they're bomb damaged, so there's often no roofs, no walls, and they were getting ruined when it rained, and in summer the sun was beating down on the books and destroying them. So people said, look, we've got to try and do something here to save these books. And they were going to put them in boxes and just store them.
Mm.
And then someone said, look, why don't we not only retrieve them, but then keep them open, don't put them in boxes, keep them open for viewing so people can read them. And then somebody else said, what, a library? And everyone thought, yes, of course, a library. And that's really where it started. And one of the most difficult things for them was that a lot of these buildings that they got these books from, the lower floor had been completely destroyed. So very often they couldn't get in through the door
right.
or through the downstairs windows, and had to scale the rubble to try and get in through an upstairs window. And then, having done that, get piles of heavy books out. And all this without being seen by snipers. So they had to keep the right side of walls to make sure they were shielded from the high buildings that weren't far away from where they were getting the books. So it was a terribly dangerous exercise from just about every point of view.
The library's in an area considered too dangerous for children to approach. However, there is one child who visits the library every day because he lives next door.
Absolutely. The wonderful Amjad, who's 14, or he was at the time I began talking to him. I'd rung trying to get through to one of the adults there who I'd been speaking to, a guy called Abdul Basit, who I was trying to contact.
Mm.
And then I got this very young voice, and he sounded more like sort of 10 than 14.
Right.
He answered Abdul Basit's phone, which he must have left on the table. And I said, oh, can I speak, please, to somebody who runs the library? And he said, you can speak to me.
Whoa.
So I said, well, you know, somebody in charge. He said, I am in charge. I am the chief librarian.
Oh, wonderful.
And he said to me, I even have my own office at the back of this library, and it's got a sign saying management on the door.
Oh.
And in there, he said, I have my own desk. Oh. It's small. Just like me.
Oh, bless him. And the irony is, and in a serious sense, it's safer in the library for him, I guess, than it is being above ground.
Well, exactly. He only found the library because it was a secret library. There were no signs to it. And many people in Daraya initially had no idea it was there because they were worried that it might get bombed by the regime planes if they knew where it was. And he was out on the streets dodging shells, and a couple of men on the street saw him and said, look, get off the streets, this is totally unsafe, the best place you can go is the secret library. And they showed him where it was after saying to him, you mustn't tell anyone without permission where this is, but you go in there. And so he went down into the library and absolutely adored the place, and talked about how he was mesmerized by the number of books there. And he said at first he tried to remember every single one, but found that almost impossible. And then he said to the people there running the library, look, can I stay? And then he went from strength to strength, virtually running the place, from just being this child who was also using the place to help catch up on his education.
What a lovely, lovely part of the story. The location of the library's secret, for obvious reasons. So how do people visit it without putting themselves in danger and everybody else who's ever visited the library, but because the attackers would just come and destroy the place, presumably?
Exactly. So it was word of mouth. That's how there's never a sign or a notice or anything to say where it was, but it was word of mouth. And what people would do is they'd say, look, only tell someone that you really trust.
Yeah.
And sometimes it wasn't that this somebody else might ring up Damascus, ring up the Assad family and say, this is where the library is. But they worried that, you know, a bit like in World War II,
yes,
sort of, you know, loose talk cost lives or whatever.
Of course.
It was just being very careful who you told. And so that's how people would find it. But it was also, as you alluded to earlier, quite a dangerous place to get to. It wasn't far from the front line, so it was difficult for many people to get there. But they did. You just had to be careful. There were certain times of the day when it was better than others, and people got to know the pattern of how the bombing tended to work,
right,
and how you could get there.
I guess the obvious question is, what were the books mainly that people were reading? What were the popular books?
Well, there were all sorts. I mean, some of the books, I'll get to the popular ones in just a second. There were some of the books which were, say, on medical subjects, which people, one particular student who was a dental student, used to try and improve his knowledge of dentistry, because he, although he'd finished his course halfway through, now was the official dentist because there were no qualified ones left. There were people who learned about how to teach, who learned how to do all sorts of other jobs around town that they got from the books. But there were also some very popular poetry books, particularly the Arabic poetry, and as well as Hamlet was one of the, this is one of the main characters in the book, Abdul Basit, who's wonderfully poetic, naturally poetic character, absolutely adored Hamlet, and said it was just like having a film screen run before your eyes when you read it because it was so pictorial. Also, things like Agatha Christie. Was another favourite of Sarah, another person I got to know there. And The Body in the Library was one of her favourite books.
Good grief!
Which I couldn't believe it when she told me that. But there were also self-help books, all kinds of things, most of them in Arabic, because there weren't very many English speakers left in Daraya. Many of the sort of most educated people had left outside of this small group of former university students.
How ironic would it have been if Syria's Secret Library book had ended up as the most popular book in Syria's Secret Library?
Well, exactly. Yes, well, I hope I don't want to give a spoiler here as to what actually happened, what the fate of the library was, but put it this way, a couple of the characters, Abdul Basit and Anas, are hoping eventually, they're now in Idlib, the much bombed Idlib, the last rebel-held province of the country, they're hoping to get a copy of that, hoping to reconstruct the library and get a copy of that in there, because everyone was evacuated in August of 2016, the end of August, when suddenly I couldn't get through to people. And then when I did, I was told, look, all hell's breaking loose. We're going to have to leave the town. We're being evacuated to other parts of Syria.
Yes, I read as part of a BBC report on it a couple of years back that they even had, at the time, their own mini frontline libraries.
Ah, yes. Now, it's good you raised that, Bill. One of the things that totally astounded me was, I asked initially, what do fighters think about people sitting around reading books?
Yes.
There they are defending the town against Syrian government forces, and there you are just reading books. And they talked about how their role was going to be played when the bullets stopped being fired, and they would try and rebuild society with the knowledge that they had. But they also said many fighters come to this library, and when they can't come here regularly, they collect, on their last visit, they'll collect a bag full of books, take them to the front line, and in their foxholes on the front line, hold book clubs, where they'd only have about one copy of each book, so they wouldn't all discuss the same book. One person would discuss the book they had read and then take questions in the foxhole, because there were times, they said to me, where you may go a whole day, even two at a time sometimes, when nothing happened on the front line, and then, of course, all hell would break loose for a while. But it was very like that, and it could be very, very cold or very, very hot, depending on the time of year. And they said these were wonderful distractions to be able to have there, and we hugely enjoyed these sessions.
It's amazing. We talk about the power of the written word. In your book, you ask Abdul Basit, that in a town that's only had access to two aid convoys in nearly 4 years, wouldn't it make more sense for them to spend time looking for food rather than for books?
Yes, he replied to me that the soul needs books just like the body needs food. He also said to me, and this was said in a very unpretentious way, he also said to me, Mike, books, they're like rain. Wherever books fall, wherever rain falls, things grow, and where books are found, knowledge grows.
How extraordinary.
Indeed, I mean, they just so adored these books. They so it gave them not only education and a window on the world, it gave them hope, because they were reading about places like, I mean, they had lectures on as well as books on places like at times like the Blitz in London.
Yes.
And they talked about how a city like London, a big world city, had parts of it had been bombed in, almost into oblivion.
Yeah.
And yet it all recovered. And they said, so that could be us. And that gave them huge hope.
It's an extraordinary story. Thank you, Mike, for coming on and talking about it. Your book is called Syria's Secret Library. Mike Thompson, the author, has joined us today. Really appreciate your time, Mike. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure, Bill.
Take care. All the best. Bye-bye.